What's going on with this?
What do you mean?
What's he doing?
There are going to be reindeer up in the balcony. He's waving at
them. He's giving the Nazi salute.
Ah, he's waving at the reindeer.
He's saying Heil Hitler.
Change has come to America.
The truth is out there.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency.
I've now been in 57 states.
From a two-story bunker somewhere in the heartland of America, this is PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert. Sharon is taking the evening off. Well, not exactly. We're getting ready for company this evening. One of Sharon's sisters will be coming to stay with us. And so we've got a lot of things to do. And thus, rather than rush a show that wasn't properly prepared, we decided to dig into the archives for another show that we consider to be a foundational show in helping to understand what's going on in the world today. We'd like to dig back about 3 years and bring out an interview that I did with author Peter Lavenda. Sharon mentioned Peter Lavenda a couple of times this week. She's gone back and rereading the books in his Sinister Forces series. But in May of 2006, I did an interview with Peter about a previous work of his about Nazis and the occult. Give it a listen. This helps explain a lot about what's happening in the world today. We're pleased to welcome back to our interview line author Peter Lavenda, whose books Sinister Forces, The Nine, A Warm Gun, and the forthcoming Manson Secret detail the history of the political occult in the United States, and his previous work, which will be the topic of our discussion today, Unholy Alliance, A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. Peter, welcome back to PID Radio.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
This is a topic that we keep bumping into unintentionally as far as the Nazis and the occult and how that aspect of Nazi Germany has influenced world history since the 1940s. I guess just to start, is it safe to say that the involvement of the Nazi Party with the occult was more than just a product of Heinrich Himmler's fevered imagination?
Oh, certainly. I mean, there was an environment in which someone like Himmler could thrive, basically, and that's what happened. There was a background to the occult in Germany that went back to before World War One. You know, in John Toland's biography of Adolf Hitler, one of the definitive biographies of Hitler, Hitler's poetry. I mean, Hitler wrote poetry in the trenches during World War One, and it was all poetry dedicated to the Teutonic gods like Odin and Wotan and that sort of thing, of Thor. So there was this idea of a inherent paganism in Germany that was the real religion or the true faith of the German people before Christianity came to the region. You know, by the Catholic Church, by missionaries, and by you know, force of arms, actually, in Germany. So there was this idea that somehow Germany was suffering because it had lost the link back to its ancient racial religion. So you had quite an environment of theosophy, spiritualism, mesmerism to a certain extent, and a lot of old Masonic and Rosicrucian secret societies and occult lodges that were really operating very well in Germany as early as the late 19th century. So you had, from the 1870s on, you had a very strong presence in Germany and in the rest of Europe, but especially so in Germany, of secret societies devoted to hermetic ideas, occult concepts, but couched in a neo-pagan framework. And all of this was current at the time that Hitler was a young man. Before he went into the war in World War One, he was reading occult magazines like Ostara that was printed by a man called Lanz von Liebenfels, who started at a secret society in Austria called the Order of the New Templars. And this was a kind of Knights Templar order with pagan and occult overtones to it. In fact, that order was begun just about the same day that Hitler's mother died in Austria. I mean, it's a coincidence of dates. And Lanz von Liebenfels was a Catholic monk who had sort of defected from the church and formed his own occult secret society. So you had guys like von Liebenfels that Hitler actually met at one point. He went to the offices of the magazine, and von Liebenfels gave him a few free copies of the magazine and some money to get home. Hitler was very, very broke in Vienna in those days. And then you had people like Guido von Liszt, who was writing about creating a kind of paganism based on the runes, the old alphabet of the Germans, with the German people, the Teutonic people, even creating a kind of yoga system based on the runes. So you had a lot of strange mystical ideas, very prevalent in Germany at the time. And out of this arose the Nazi Party.
What were the outlines of this mystic belief?
Well, it depends who you talk to. There were a lot of theorists around at the time who were trying to push their own agenda. But basically speaking, number one, the idea is that there is a mystical knowledge that not everyone has, and that you have to study it or be initiated into a secret society to find out what it is. And this mystical knowledge will give you occult power. But that's a major facet of almost every secret society, whether it's German or you know, no matter what country or what realm you come from. There's this idea that there's occult knowledge, hidden knowledge, that the man in the street doesn't know. And the only way you're going to find out is if you make contact with other people who do know. Now, although this is common to everyone, the German variation on this was that this secret knowledge was racial in nature, that the blood had the secret. Your own race had somehow the secret built inside of you, in your DNA, let's say, which, of course, there was no DNA knowledge of DNA at the time. But there was this idea that there was a racial memory, there was a racial heritage, and that purity of the race would enable you to go back in time through meditation and through occult practice to make contact with the ancient gods and the ancient practices and the ancient knowledge. So there was a combination of what you might call theosophy or general occult ideas mixed with this idea of race. This was very important to people like Lanz von Liebenfels, Guido von Liszt, and all of the other occult gurus of the time. The belief that the German people built into them, hardwired into the German people, was the ability to tap powerful occult forces. And that if the race had been polluted, in the terms the Nazis used, if there had been intermarriage with other races, then the power would have been less and less. This is why in the SS, for instance, you had to prove your racial purity. Going back generations to the year 1750, you had to be able to document that you were a pure German, a pure Aryan, as they would say, going back that long, over about 200 years. If you could prove that, then you were allowed to become a member of the elite SS, which was basically a kind of cult that had been created by Himmler.
Was this a racial memory that traced lineage back to a Christian or Hebrew scholars would call the Nephilim, the angels who came down to Earth and mated with
sure.
humans, or
sure.
the Anunnaki, if you will.
Yeah, you could say that. In fact, from the point of view of the German theorists of this doctrine, there's a reversal taking place in biblical legend. To the Nazis, Lucifer, for instance, was an angel of light. And they adopted this from Blavatsky, I mean, and her Theosophical Society. They published a magazine called Lucifer. This did not mean that they were Satanists the way we would understand it, because what they did was they redefined all of these terms. So for them, the God of the Old Testament is not God. It's actually a satanic figure, which is the Gnostic idea. So they go back to a kind of warmed over Gnosticism, a kind of duality. And to them, the idea of the Jewish people being the chosen ones, it takes on a reversal in their mind. The Jewish people are chosen not by God, but by the devil. So they interpreted everything backwards this way. And so their ancient racial memory, let's use another that term for it, nothing else, supposedly goes back to ancient times, I mean, hundreds of thousands of years ago, going back to before humans as we know them walked the earth, maybe to some preternatural form, in which at which time human beings had all these marvelous occult powers. And what happened was the race, the German race or the Aryan race as they called it, became diluted through interaction with other races. And they would specify Jews, Slavs, Asiatics, quote unquote, or whatever was not pure Aryan or pure German. Once the intermarriage took place, then the race became polluted and they lost their powers. So the occultists were trying to find ways to bring these powers back. So when you mention the Nephilim or the Anunnaki, this is the concept, except they would have rejected the term Nephilim. They would have identified with the Nephilim, probably.
Mm-hmm.
They would identify with the Anunnaki and say that's where their origins came from. But they were not that sophisticated. They were just talking about Teutonic times, Teutonic deities, and interpreting their origins that way. A purely Nordic, ice-bound, ice-originated race, a race that came from the cold countries, that came from ice, and that they identified with Arctic regions.
Now, you mentioned Madame Blavatsky. How influential was her work on what developed into the Nazi belief system?
Well, Blavatsky's influence was extraordinary. You have to realize that what Blavatsky did was form a bulwark against materialism in the late 19th century by saying, yes, you know, science is correct insofar as it goes, and that even evolution, Darwinian evolution, is correct insofar as it goes, but it's only part of the story. Blavatsky was able to take whatever was known about science in general terms in those days and redefine all of that within an occult spiritual context. So theosophy had tremendous effect not only on the Nazis, but on British secret societies, French, Italian, and American secret societies that had nothing to do with the Nazis and nothing to do with ideas of racial purity. But her influence was paramount. So you had a number of occult organizations in Germany that were heavily influenced by theosophy, that many of whose members were theosophists, who then went on to join other secret societies and to bring her influence there. I think that her influence was, I think we're only beginning now to understand how deep and how broad her influence was over the entire occult revival of the late 19th and early 20th century. The idea of the Aryan race is lifted from Blavatsky. The sacredness of the swastika, Blavatsky was writing about that in The Secret Doctrine, years before Hitler was born. So there was this idea that the swastika was a sacred symbol, that the Aryan race was a specially evolved race, the fifth root race, I believe it's called, and that the Germans identified very strongly with these ideas is obvious from their writings. It's obvious from the writings of all the authors of occult racism in Germany at that time.
So who took the ideas that Blavatsky developed and then shaped them into the form that we saw come to fruition in the 1930s in Germany?
Well, it actually began earlier than that. It began in World War One. Towards the end of World War One, communism was on the rise. There had been a communist revolution in Russia. The Communist Party was very contagious, you might say. It was affecting Germans in particular. The German soldiers going to Russia were told by the Russian soldiers, "We're not mad at you. Go home and create a new revolution." The Germans had been defeated in World War One. The Communist Party and the Socialist parties were very strong in Munich, in Berlin, everywhere. The German Navy was flying the red socialist flag. You have to understand, at that point in 1918, Germany was in danger of completely falling apart into separate little city-states. Each of them had a very strong socialist presence. So this was exerting tremendous pressure upon the industrialists in Germany, upon property owners, factory owners. They found themselves in danger of being eradicated by this new philosophy. So there was a lot of money being paid to underground movements to try to resist socialism and to resist communism. And one of the most famous of these was an organization called the Thule Gesellschaft, which met at the Four Seasons Hotel in Munich. Now, this was run by a guy called Baron Rudolf von Sabbatendorf, and this was a real character. This was somebody who had traveled in the Middle East, who claimed to be a Freemason, who claimed he was initiated into Oriental mysteries, as he called it, in the Middle East, and was now creating an occult society at the Four Seasons Hotel, teaching, again, the philosophies of race, the philosophies of occultism and hermeticism, and using the swastika as a symbol. All of this was taking place at the time that Germany was in danger of really falling apart. Munich had been taken over by socialists. There was a socialist president or mayor, you might say, of Munich. And members of the Thule Gesellschaft, this German nationalist secret society, were taken out one day and shot against a wall on, I believe it was April 30th, 1919. This became the battle cry, or lit the fuse, for a general revolt of the German secret societies against the socialists. Now, if you can imagine this, in November of 1919, we have what is essentially a street-by-street fight between occultists and communists.
Wow. That's
what you had in Munich at that time. It's like something out of a fantasy novel. You had people who were members of this occult society on the streets fighting against the communists. It was bizarre.
Was it reported that way in the press over here? Or was it remembered that way in history books?
It was not really, no. It was reported as, you know, German nationalist movements or anti-communist movements without going into too much detail as to
right.
who they are or who ran them. But this was the very first time that you had armies marching under the swastika banner. You had a swastika battalion marching into Munich to free Munich from the communists at that time. And everything was being run out of the Four Seasons Hotel by Baron Sobotendorf and the Thule Gesellschaft. That was the nerve center for this revolt against the communists. So once they won, and which they did, they found themselves in a position of tremendous authority and power in Munich and Bavaria in general. And Hitler, who had just come back from the trenches, had just come back from this horrible defeat of the Germans at the end of World War I, was sent to spy on the Thule Gesellschaft. And he went to the Four Seasons Hotel and listened to the speeches about occultism, listened to the speeches about the German race and the Aryan race, and eventually joined a political action group of the Thule Gesellschaft known as the German Workers' Party. He became member number 555 of mm-hmm. the German Workers' Party.
Mm-hmm.
He later had his membership card amended, I think, to make member number 7. But initially, he was member 555. And within short order, took over that group, and it became the National Socialist German Workers' Party, or the NSDAP, the Nazi Party. So the origins of the Nazi Party began with the Thule Gesellschaft, began with an occult secret society, and their symbol at that time was the swastika. That's where it came from.
Okay. Now, how did it grow from there? I mean, there certainly were elements of the SS and that went far beyond just a belief that the German people were somehow special because of their bloodline.
We must remember that this was the fundamental understanding mm-hmm. of the Nazi Party. We begin there first, because that explains the Nuremberg laws. It explains the laws against the Jews. It explains the Holocaust and the concentration camps. All of this goes back to the Thule Gesellschaft. Mm-hmm. All of it goes back to occult ideas regarding race and religion. If we begin there, and as the German, as the Nazi Party grew, what happened was you had elements that were more military in nature, you had elements that were more political, and you had Hitler trying to manage all of this, and you had the SS, which was a combination, kind of a police force in its early days, and a cult. So when Himmler became involved and Himmler took over the SS, he didn't create it, but he took it over. That's at the point where Himmler decided to create this new order. He wanted to pattern it on the Jesuits, whom he idolized as being, you know, this super elite and super efficient organization, even so far as to copying the color black for the uniforms.
That's interesting.
He idolized the Jesuits. A lot of Germans did, although they despised them at the same time. They feared them. They also emulated them. They wanted to create a kind of Jesuit order of their own, and that was what the SS was supposed to be. And that went all the way through to creating their castle near Paderborn in Germany at Wevelsburg. That's another story we can get into a little later. But
sure.
What happened was Himmler took over the religious function, we might say, of the Nazi Party, And you had the Wehrmacht, which was the army itself, which was the military function. You had Hitler running the politics and trying to keep all of these three major groups running efficiently. And they all wore swastikas, and they all, you know, swore devotion to the ideas of the Nazi Party, which were supremacy of the German people racially and morally and ethically and in every other way. So that was the foundation. That was something that they all believed. Some to lesser extent, some to greater extent. Himmler was a fanatic about it. Goebbels was a kind of fanatic, the propaganda minister. He believed in all of this entirely. People like Goering and Bormann, perhaps they were more politically minded and less religiously fanatic. But then you had people like Mengele and Eichmann, and who were true believers also. I mean, Eichmann's first job was monitoring the Masons, was keeping tabs on Freemasons.
Interesting. And I want to go there, too, and find out a little bit more about the antipathy of the Nazi Party toward the Freemasons. Peter, there were some very interesting scientific expeditions that were undertaken at the behest of Heinrich Himmler, especially the ones into the Himalayas. What were they all about?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of the doctrine, very complicated doctrine of the Nazi Party regarding the superiority of the German people, was this idea that the Germans were part of something called the Aryan race. And the Aryan race were believed to have originated somewhere either in the Caucasus or in the Himalayan mountains themselves. Himmler believed that Tibet held the secrets of the origins of the Aryan people. So he financed expeditions to Tibet to try to find out as much as possible about their religion, about their scriptures, their occult practices. All of this he needed brought back to Germany. And he was financing these expeditions as late as 1937-38. Which means right when the war was starting to get hot and right when international tensions were at their highest, Himmler had sent a group of scientists to Tibet, claiming these were the first white people to visit Tibet, which of course was not true, but those were the claims made in the newspapers, and had sent these organizations out there to find out what they could about Tibetan mysticism and Tibetan religion. He had sent a number of people who were actually well-known archaeologists of the time, not just in Germany, but internationally well-known, who were members of a group within the SS called the Ahnenerbe, which was the Ancestral Heritage Research Division of the SS. Ancestral heritage is the key. Trying to find out not only the origins of the German people, or the Aryan people, but exactly how far afield you could find evidence that the Germans had lived and had helped develop societies, civilizations around the world. So basically what happened was you sent archaeologists to various places, to Asia, to the Taklimakan Desert, which is in the far western part of China and north of Pakistan, and to dig around and see if they could find pots with, you know, swastikas inscribed on them that were thousands of years old. If they could do that, they were happy. They figured that was evidence the Aryans had been there. Of course, the swastika is an ancient symbol. I mean, everyone, you'll find swastikas used by American Indians. You'll find them used in China among Chinese Buddhists, for instance. In India, it's a very popular symbol. So you were almost guaranteed to find swastikas almost anywhere on Earth. And this gave credence to the German claim that the Aryans were once the masters of human civilization. So he sent, as I mentioned, this one expedition to Tibet. They came back with newsreel footage, with which you can still see. It's been some of this footage has been replayed on various television stations, for instance, on the History Channel, places mm-hmm. like that. When they do a special on this, you'll see some of this very old footage that was taken by the Nazis while they were there, and photographs of religious rituals. They took back a lot of artifacts. They took back the Tibetan scriptures, an entire copy of those. They brought on the backs of mules and camels across dangerous mountain passes. All of this was being done just before the war actually broke out. But there was another element to this as well. Some Tibetans and an entire group of people in India believe that Hitler was a spiritual leader, was an avatar. And one of the reasons they thought this was, of course, the use of the swastika, which to the Indians is a very sacred symbol. So they began to think that maybe Hitler was coming to free them, liberate them from the British. You know, India at that time was a British colony.
Right.
So you had leaders like Chandra Bose, who was a very popular Indian nationalist leader, who virtually worshipped Hitler, wrote a lot of articles about the Nazi Party, a lot of articles about Germany, a lot of articles about Hitler, promoting this idea that Hitler was going to be their spiritual liberator. And his idea was to raise an army in India to meet Hitler's forces when they crossed the Suez Canal into the Middle East. They would join up and then take over the rest of the world from there. So you had this very strong idea among a lot of Indians and some Tibetans that maybe the Nazi Party was a spiritual force to be reckoned with, and maybe that it was on their side. One of the archaeologists, before we move from that subject, one of the archaeologists on that Tibet expedition is a man called Bruno Beger.
Yes.
This is a person that sort of shows you what we're dealing with. Here was a perfectly innocuous expedition to Tibet, we might say. I mean, nobody was being killed. Nobody was being tortured. These were scientists on a mission of discovery. They come back to Germany in 38. By 38, 39, the war is starting to break out. Hitler's invaded Poland, Czechoslovakia. It's all starting to happen. He's taken back Austria. And the first camps, the first concentration camps are being set up. One of the most famous was at Dachau. And at Dachau, they performed a lot of medical experiments. Well, one of the archaeologists and scientists involved in these experiments was Bruno Beger himself. The man who went to Tibet later came back to Germany and was one of the people or the person responsible for selecting human skulls for a museum of race. And he would collect these skulls by visiting live prisoners at Dachau and deciding which skulls he wanted and telling the authorities to kill these people and preserve the skulls and have them sent to him. So here was this monster engaged in hideous activities during the war. Only a year before, had been visiting Tibet, the land of the Dalai Lama, the land of mysticism and peace and compassion. So, you know, what was this all about? You know, it makes me sometimes wonder a little bit also about the Dalai Lama, who had a number of Nazis as friends during that time, who had befriended him when he was a young man.
Right.
Heinrich Harrer. The adventurer who wrote 7 Years in Tibet, which they made the movie with Brad Pitt, playing him. I mean, here was an SS officer, you know, who downplayed his role in the SS when he was writing about his trip in Tibet. But the reason he was in Tibet was because the war had broken out. He was in India, which was British territory. He fled to Tibet and for years soaked up, you know, Tibetan doctrine as well. But he was only one of many Germans and Nazis and SS officers who had been to Tibet and were doing the same sorts of things.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned Dr. Bruno Beger. There's a picture on the Dalai Lama's website, the official Government of Tibet and Exiles website, dated 1994, which features the Dalai Lama standing with a group of Westerners, among whom are Mr. Heinrich Harrer and Dr. Bruno Beger,
right,
who remained friends of his into the 90s. Now, it's not likely that the Dalai Lama was unaware of their affiliations or their actions, given the amount of attention that had been paid to, you know, the Nazi Party in the aftermath of World War II. So, which raises another question. What similarities, parallels, or connections might there have been between the particular type of tantric Buddhism practiced by the Dalai Lama and the beliefs of the Nazi Party?
Wow. Well, there you struck on it. I mean, you struck on what's probably going to be the material for at least a dozen doctoral theses that I can think of. I mean, you're right there at the crux of the matter. I mean, what was the connection? How was the Dalai Lama, I mean, whom we credit with such spiritual sensitivity, how was he able to stand next to someone like Bruno Beger? I mean, here was a man responsible, and it's documented. His atrocities are well known. I mean, there's no escaping it. Heinrich Harrer, well, we could go either way. He was an SS officer, which meant automatically after the war he was considered an enemy, a war criminal, as was Beger himself. So you ask yourself, you know, how could the Dalai Lama, you know, really stand there and accept these people? As I said in my in Unholy Alliance, what did he know, and, you know, and when did he know it?
Mm-hmm.
The old Watergate question. But Tibetan Tantra and the practices of Tibetan Tantra are not pure Buddhism in the sense that we understand it from India and from the Gautama Buddha and the Buddhist scriptures. Tibetan tantricism comes from another source. I mean, it's much older, and Buddhism is kind of a veneer over it. You have the native Tibetan religion, which is called Bern, B-O-N, with an umlaut over the O, so pronounced sort of Bern, the Bern religion, which was a pagan faith, very complicated, but which also has a number of things that we might object to in their ritual repertoire. You know, some of the implements that they use are made out of human skulls and human bones, for instance.
Yeah.
They believe in contacting the spiritual forces. They're kind of shamanistic that way. There's all sorts of deep rituals involving blood and involving sacrifice. So, you know, what was the relationship between that and the Nazis? Did the Dalai Lama see some kind of a finer connection between the two cultures that we don't see or that we're only beginning to see? It's a fascinating question. It deserves a lot further examination because we're too ready to accept the sort of Richard Gere version of Tibetan Buddhism, you know, the kind of all peaceful, all compassionate version. There's another element to it, and there's been a lot of infighting in Tibet even before the Chinese invaded. There has been a lot of people nominated as Dalai Lama who mysteriously died after a couple of months or a year. A lot of internecine warfare there. So the picture that is presented is one that is beautiful and worthy of emulation, but the history tells you something else.
It was very telling statement, let's say a very astute statement that was made by Christopher Hitchens some years back, who made the observation that the Dalai Lama has somehow reached a point in the public perception that he is judged by his reputation rather than by his words and actions.
Right.
Yeah, which
and,
is.
Yeah, I read that, and I have to agree, although I don't always agree with Christopher Hitchens. In this case, his remarks on Tibetan Buddhism and the Dalai Lama, I think, were rather astute.
Yeah. Were there other sources of power that Himmler and or the Nazis tried to tap for their own purposes?
Absolutely. I mean, the journey to Tibet was only one of the things that Himmler was financing. He definitely wanted to find the Holy Grail. This was something that was of tremendous importance to him.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit about that in my book as well, and I think other researchers are now going and looking at this. He was financing a search for the Grail, very similar to the Indiana Jones film concept that we're familiar with, but that's based on reality. The Nazis were trying to find artifacts of power, relics of different religions, of different faiths. It didn't matter. But as long as they were believed to have spiritual power within them, the Nazis wanted them, and they financed expeditions everywhere. Tibet was only one of these. The other was the search for the Grail, and they had a young SS officer, Otto Rahn, that they sent looking for it. And Rahn was a kind of archaeologist, anthropologist, who studied the Cathars, the Knights Templar, and all of these things, which have become now a bit better known with the Da Vinci Code. And here he was in the 1930s searching, you know, with a mandate by Heinrich Himmler. He was part of Himmler's personal staff, being sent to look for the Grail and to report back when he found it. I mean, a bizarre concept if you put your mind to it. Here's a man eventually in the full-blown SS uniform, you know, looking for the Grail. It's like something out of a bad movie also. Did he find it? That's the big question. He died quite mysteriously before the real war broke out. He had done a lot of research. He had been to the south of France and the Pyrenees looking for the Grail. He had been to Rennes-le-Château, which comes up again in the Da Vinci Code material and other books about it. He had been to the caves. He had been to Montségur. He was looking for the Grail everywhere. He wrote a couple of books regarding his searches, regarding paganism, very anti-Catholic, very anti-Christian. And then goes back to Germany, is sent to Dachau for training, because Dachau was both a concentration camp and a training camp for the SS. And shortly after his training was complete, he was dead. He was on a climbing in the hills and died of exposure, they say, in the spring in Germany. You know, an unbelievable story, but possibly murdered. You know, possibly even a suicide. We don't know.
The Spear of Destiny, was that one of the artifacts that was brought back to Germany?
Absolutely. I mean, there was a definite urge on Hitler's part personally to get the Spear of Destiny. He had seen it in Vienna in the museum there when he was a young man. And, you know, Hitler was obsessed with Wagner and with Wagnerian opera. So when he saw the spear, it was Parsifal, it was Tannhäuser, it was the whole Götterdämmerung coming at him with the sight of that. And what he wanted to do was to get that as well for the Germans. I mean, it was in Austria anyway, which he took over and where he was born. So the spear was taken from the museum, brought to Germany, and it was eventually replaced after the war. But the Spear of Destiny, the Holy Grail, some say the Ark of the Covenant, that's a possibility. There's some documents that talk about it. So there was definitely this idea that he wanted to accumulate all of these treasures in one place, and that Himmler and the SS was the force that was going out to do this for him. We don't know how many other things they brought back. They brought back a lot of things from Asia. They brought back a lot of things from the Middle East. We don't even begin to know how much that they did bring back and how much of it has since wound up in private collections around the world.
Mm-hmm. There was another artifact that was mentioned sort of tangentially in the Bible that's kind of intrigued me. In the book of Revelation, one of the messages from Jesus given to John is directed to the church of Pergamum, in which he mentions that he knows that they are living in the seat of Satan's power or something to that effect. They live at the seat of Satan's power. And I had read that the Nazis took an altar from the Temple of Zeus at Pergamum and brought it back to Berlin. Do you know anything about that?
That story was prevalent, I believe, before the war started. This is when we had a lot of German archaeologists in the Middle East in the 1930s, after Hitler came to power in 33. From 33 to about 38, Nazi archaeologists were all over the place, especially all over the Middle East. And they did take a lot of artifacts back from the Middle East and brought them back to Germany. That story I've heard. I don't know if it's true or not. Like I say, a lot of that information was destroyed at the end of the war. Himmler ordered a lot of documents destroyed. Hitler ordered a lot destroyed. So we don't know the provenance of some of these artifacts. We don't know where they came from. We don't know where they are now.
Hmm.
But it's entirely possible they did. I mean, their interest in archaeology was not a purely academic one. Their interest in archaeology was something far deeper than that. Even Lawrence, T.E. Lawrence, ran into German archaeologists before World War I, who were, you know, always in the same area that he was in when he was a young archaeologist and always looking for artifacts to bring back to Germany. This was something that was been going on for a long time, and it was not a purely academic research. These were practically grave robbers, you might say. They were just on a search and destroy mission. They just wanted to find what they could find and bring it back. So this was a kind of a culture of archaeology that went on that was sort of exacerbated when the Nazis took power.
How much of a believer was Hitler in the occult aspects of the Nazi belief system?
I believe from my reading of Hitler's own writings, from the talks that he had with other people, such as his photographer and Hans Stengel and some of the others, he did truly believe in the big picture occultism. I don't think he was so much concerned with, I mean, I can't imagine Hitler himself, you know, practicing ceremonial rituals. I think his idea was that, you know, as the leader of Germany, he was sort of the master magician. He didn't have to bother himself with such petty stuff like that. He had others to do it for him. You know, like Himmler, I could easily imagine, you know, performing occult rituals. But Hitler, no. I think Hitler saw himself as the Indians saw him, as a kind of avatar, as what I call in the book an occult messiah. I think that he believed in creating the new man. This is something that he mentioned many times. He believed in creating a new the next step of evolution, you might say, a new type of human being. And he thought that in Germany they were going to do that. It was going to involve eugenics, racial theories. It was going to involve a new religion. You know, the SS abolished Christianity. You cannot be a Christian and be a member of the SS. All the religious rituals were changed. There was a kind of baptism, which was bringing into to the Aryan faith. There was a kind of Christmas thing, which was Yule, the old pagan holiday. Mm-hmm. You could not mention the word Christmas in any official documents of the Nazi Party, not just the SS, but Nazism in general. So there was a deliberate attempt to eradicate Christianity and to create a new human being that was composed not only of pure German blood, but a kind of pure German faith to go with it. So Hitler did believe, I think, very seriously in that. From everything I've been able to read, Hitler had this sort of Superman, Nietzschean concept of what he was trying to accomplish.
But as far as the, say, the nuts and bolts aspects of it, the ritual aspects of which Himmler, for which Himmler is known, Hitler was not a participant in that at that level?
I don't think so. I mean, I've read a lot of speculative stuff about this. The book Sphere of Destiny by Ravenscroft talks about Hitler attending seances and stuff, but there's been very little documentation to support it. I think when he was a young man in Vienna before World War I, he read a lot of this material. We know it's been documented. He read a lot of Ostara, this occult magazine. He drank it in. But I think I don't think he was out there performing rituals, or he may have attended a few, just to see what they were all about. But Hitler was a kind of restless person, and more of a man of action than anything else. And I don't see Hitler doing the prerequisite of fasting and meditating and all the rest of it. I think he wanted a quick way, you know, to gain power, and using symbols and creating the Nuremberg rallies and performing ritual of that nature, Hitler was perfect for. You know, and he was trained in this, and he was trained in how to speak to people professionally, and he was trained by occultists. He was trained by hypnotists and magicians who taught him how to speak, who taught him how to move and how to express himself. All of these things he understood. And in those monstrous rallies he created, those were rituals. Anyone watching that could not come away with any other idea. These were rituals he was performing, and his speeches were incantatory. They were like chants. Even people who didn't understand German were swept away by it. And that's the stamp of a magician.
You mentioned that he'd been trained by occultists. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. His primary teacher where this was concerned was a man called Hanussen. Hanussen was a popular sort of stage occultist, hypnotist, if you will. He was an astrologer. He predicted the future. He actually created a kind of salon in Berlin where very important Nazis were and industrialists and people in high society were invited, and he would conduct all sorts of experiments and demonstrations of psychic abilities at these things. Well, back in before Hitler became powerful, he had befriended Hanussen or vice versa. I think Hanussen saw in Hitler something that could be trained and molded. And he realized that Hitler had a hard time dealing with people. I mean, Hitler had a lot of very passionate ideas, but in relating to humans on a one-to-one level, Hitler was kind of stiff, was sort of an Al Gore, an Al Gore with a swastika armband. And, you know, a kind of a hard way of actually connecting with people. And Hanussen was able to train him in how to project himself, in how to pace his speeches, on how to reach high points, go back down to low points, build up a head of steam with rhythmic words, with alliteration, with all of this, until he actually was, in a sense, talking the way you might think a voodoo drum was beating.
Well, the way you describe that almost sounds like a pattern that I've detected among some fundamentalist Christian preachers.
Well, it's very effective. You know, it's a very effective means of getting a point across without actually having to logically dissect it. I mean, it plays on the emotions directly, and this is exactly what Hitler said in his own writings that he wanted to do. He wanted to get past the mind, get past the intellect, which he did not trust, get past the thinking mechanisms completely, and go straight to the heart of people, straight to their emotions, and talk directly to that. That's what Hitler was writing about in Mein Kampf. That's what he was writing about in his speeches, in his table talk with the photographer friend, and with people like Rauschning and the others. He said he wants to go straight to the person's soul. I mean, he was talking about magic, was what he was talking about. Let's go straight there. Let's manipulate people. Let's take their emotions, and they'll follow you anywhere. And this was Hitler's idea. You know, let's not bother people with the details. Let's not bother them with the facts. Let's just get them all worked up. And Hanussen, an occultist and an astrologer, and the man who predicted precisely when Hitler would come to power,
really,
is the man who taught Hitler this. This is a very strange story, but one which is covered in the documentation, and we can't fault it. Hitler was in deep trouble in Germany in 1932, towards the end of 1932. His girlfriend Eva Braun had tried to commit suicide. That was on Halloween, of all things. That news they were struggling to keep out of the press because that was bad enough. Hitler was losing seats in the German Bundestag, in the German parliament. He was in danger of having his party basically sidelined completely. Hanussen told him that if he were to go to his place of birth, to a cemetery, and pull out a mandrake root at the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve. I'm not making this up. If you were to do this at that time, you would then become the leader of Germany. And Hitler said, could you do this for me? So, once again, Hitler himself not actually taking part. Hanussen went out to Hitler's hometown, Braunau am Inn in Austria, and he went at the stroke of midnight, found a mandrake root, pulled it up at the right time, or so he said, came back and told Hitler, you will become Chancellor of Germany on January 31st. This is a month in advance when Hitler thought his life was falling apart completely. And because of some internecine politics with Hindenburg and everyone else, on January 31st, 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany.
How about that?
And by the way, January 31st is a famous pagan holiday also. So that's the day that Hitler came to power. Hanussen made an impossible prediction, but it came true to the day.
131, so, and of course, or 33, which is also a significant number.
Sure.
Yeah.
So here we have suddenly Hitler, because of Hanussen, learning how to speak, learning how to make speeches, learning how to move, how to use hand gestures, and at the same time relying upon the same man to ensure he becomes Chancellor of Germany. So, of course, Hitler paid him back. A few years later, Hanussen was taken out to the woods and shot.
No good deed goes unpunished, huh?
Exactly.
Well, the significance of what all of this led to can't be understated, I think. And I think most of us who are working from the little bit of history that we're taught in the public school system are of a belief that the Nazi party and its beliefs just sort of evaporated after World War II. We caught all the bad guys, tried them all at Nuremberg, and life went on fine from there. Is that really what happened?
If we were talking about any other country and any other political party, that might have made sense to a point. But to me, as I say in my book, the Nazi Party was not a political party. The Nazi Party was a cult. And if you look at the Nazi Party as a cult, everything becomes clear. People who are true believers don't give up their true belief just because they've lost a war.
Mm-hmm.
People who are dedicated to the Nazi ideals would not have just simply walked away and said, oh, well, we lost. You know, let's become good citizens of the world now. That wasn't going to happen. These were people responsible for some hideous crimes, for some horrendous acts. People with a kind of coldness, cynicism, at the same time a passionate belief in their own superiority. That doesn't go away overnight. That doesn't go away because you lost a war. That might be true for some of the soldiers in the army, in the Wehrmacht, who just wanted to get home, be with their families, that sort of thing. But for the SS, that was not possible. For that reason, the Allied forces considered the SS a criminal organization. Every member of the SS was a criminal, as far as Nuremberg was concerned. And a lot of SS men tried to hide their association. They did whatever they could, but they didn't abandon their beliefs. And just as, I hate to make this comparison, but Christians were persecuted for the first 300 years. They had mm-hmm. to meet in catacombs and in tombs. They didn't abandon their beliefs because of their persecutions.
Right.
And on the dark side, the Nazis did not either. The Nazis viewed themselves as underdogs who were being persecuted by an evil conspiracy. And what they needed to do was to maintain their connections, maintain their networks, because one day they would rise again. So we had people like Skorzeny, Hitler's favorite commando, who was running something which the novelists have called Odessa, but which is a very accurate term, because some of the Nazis used the term Odessa themselves, an underground network, an organization of former SS officers around the world who helped each other escape in the first place, to escape Nuremberg, to escape the wrath of the Allies. They went to South America, as we all know. They went to North America. They went to the Middle East. They went to Australia. They wound up all over the world in hiding, financed by the money the Germans had stolen during the course of the war. So Skorzeny was very close friends with Francisco Franco in Spain. Franco covered the Nazi networks for a long time with Juan Perón in Argentina, mm-hmm. Stroessner in Paraguay. There were a lot of heads of state around the world who were very sympathetic to the Nazis, who had declined to declare war against Nazi Germany until the very last day, just to be politically correct, who had given a lot of cover. So these people were doing well after the war. Klaus Barbie in Bolivia, Here was the butcher of Lyon in France, a man famous for his depravity, famous for his torturing of political prisoners, the ultimate SS officer, who wound up in Bolivia at one point, becoming head of the Bolivian secret police, you know, as late as the 1960s and 1970s. Here was a guy who was running the show. They used to have parties in La Paz, replete with swastika flags and singing the Horst Wessel song and the whole thing. And so this was going on decades after the end of the war. Chile was and still is a famous place where Nazis were hiding out for a long time, with a large German population that was very supportive of them, Argentina, Paraguay. The Middle East, Syria, we have Alois Brunner still alive in Damascus, a man responsible for the deaths of 300,000 people in the camps, who was then training the secret services of Damascus, of Syria, of Lebanon, of Egypt, you know, involved with Nasser in those days, training his people to go after Jews in Egypt. I mean, they didn't go away. You know, this was not, they were not going to abandon their faith. And they kept it up until, it's still going on. I mean, they just raided Colonia Dignidad in Chile a few years ago, the place that I investigated back in the 70s. And the documents that have come out since then, there's been a trial this past few months of the man who ran that colony, a mysterious estate in Chile, high up in the Andes Mountains, which, as we now discover, and which I had been writing about for years and no one wanted to hear it, was a safe house for Nazi war criminals. This was a place the Nazis could stay. It was right on the border of Argentina and Chile. They could run across the border in either direction, you know, as whenever they had to. And they were running guns. They were running drugs. And they were using Colonia Dignidad as a base for something called Operation Condor.
Operation Condor.
Condor. Mm-hmm. This was a South America-wide network that went after supposed communists, socialists, or just enemies of whatever regime happened to be in power. They would kidnap people, murder them, assassinate them. And it didn't matter if it was in South America, Europe, or the United States. We know that Orlando Letelier, who was an ambassador from Chile, was murdered in Washington, D.C. Back in the 70s. This was after the country had been overthrown. There was a president called Salvador Allende, who was a socialist. He was an elected president. There was a military coup. Allende was killed. The generals took over Chile, and then they went after enemies of the regime. And one of their most vocal opponents was a man called Letelier. His car was car bombed in Washington. He and his associate, Ronnie Moffat, were both killed. And as it turns out, all of those tendrils go back through anti-Castro Cubans, who actually effected the bomb, to an American called Michael Townley, who designed the bomb. And Michael Townley was the son of an American Ford Motor Company representative in Chile. Townley was a rabid fascist, a rabid pro-Nazi, and his links to that colony, Colonia Dignidad, are very strong. He designed the torture chambers at the colony, where people could be tortured by remote control. So you would essentially put a political prisoner, tie them up to a device. They would never see who was torturing them. They would never see who was asking them questions. It was all done with microphones and loudspeakers. And a man in a control booth could effectively interrogate half a dozen prisoners at once. So he designed this. He was an electronics expert. So, and very pro-Nazi. This was run by a former SS officer, Paul Schaefer, not to be confused with the guy who plays for Letterman.
Right.
They were both bald, however. But Paul Schaefer was a Baptist minister in Germany after the war, supposedly. He was wanted in Germany for pedophilia, for child abuse charges. He fled Germany in 1962, brought a lot of Germans with him to Chile, set up this estate, and had the complete protection of the German military.
Chilean military?
Chilean military.
Yeah.
Well, excuse me, not German military. Well, yes, hardly any difference. If you go to Chile, they wear the Wehrmacht-style helmets. They goose-step. Hey, it's an easy mistake.
Interesting. Yes, yeah. This sounds like something that has been described by researcher Dave Emery as the underground Reich. Would you agree with that assessment of the post-World War II influence of Nazi beliefs around the world? Is there an underground organization that is quietly influencing the direction of history over the last 50 years or so?
As much as they're able to, certainly there is. I mean, just in the case of Colonia Dignidad alone, which is one element of a much larger network. We've discovered in the documents that were taken evidence of a worldwide network of Germans who were supporting the colony financially and morally and in other ways. This was only a drop in the bucket. Konidignidad is only the most obvious, the most visible part of this network. But when I was in Chile, when I was investigating the colony, the local military told me that the colony was being supported by funds from all over the world, including from the United States, that money was pouring into their bank account in Parral, in the tiny town next to the colony, have been coming in there for years, that they were wealthy. This money is coming from somewhere, you know, and it's coming from a network of people who are supporting the colony. They built an airstrip at the colony. They were flying planes in and out without going through customs or immigration. They didn't have any problem with that. So who were they smuggling the guns to? You know, to whom were they selling the drugs, and what were they doing with the money? All of these things go back to evidence of a underground network, an underground Reich, you might say, or a Fourth Reich,
mm-hmm.
That is trying to hold itself together and is trying to influence politics, and they're doing that in the Middle East. They've been successful there for many years, and they're trying to influence opinion here as well, because for a long time, it was much better to be anti-communist than it was to be anti-Nazi.
Right.
In our country, we kind of closed a blind eye to the activities of Nazis in our country after the war, as long as they were anti-communist, as long as they helped us against the Soviet Union. We didn't much care about their past. We helped a lot of people escape. We just found out a couple of weeks ago that the CIA knew all about where Adolf Eichmann was mm-hmm. in Argentina years before he was picked up by the Israelis. And we simply didn't tell anybody. We kept it quiet. The West Germans told the CIA where he was, gave him his address. We said nothing. We did nothing to do anything about Klaus Barbie or Mengele or any of the others that we knew were in South America. So there's been this unspoken protection of these people that goes back a long time. That means they had ability to influence our politics, to influence our foreign policy, God forbid our domestic policy as well, you know. So I firmly believe this. This is not the end. Colonia Dignidad is only a kind of warning, a wake-up call.
Well, to what end? What would be the goal, then, of this underground Reich?
I don't think the goals have seriously changed much since the days of the Second World War. Possibly they've become a bit more accommodating where other races are concerned, if only because it's more practical in the short term. They would never have been friendly with some of the people they've had to deal with in South America, for instance, from a purely racial point of view. They would have looked down on them during the war, but now in these days they're perfectly happy to work with them if they have to. I think there's the idea that they want to reinstate their power, and if they can't do it in Germany, they will do it somewhere else. They tried to do it in Bolivia. They've tried to do it in Chile. They're trying to operate below the radar. But they want to bring back their ideals, and their ideals are racial superiority, implementing a kind of eugenics system for, you know, eradicating people that we don't like, eradicating the handicapped, eradicating the mentally ill, for instance, starting there as they did in Germany, mm-hmm. putting programs like this into place and slowly building on that until they get back to where they were back in 1938. I think their goal is eventually that.
Let me throw this out. Do you see any connection between this belief system and, say, a group of European nobility, like the Royal Dragon Court, for example? And I want to single them out, but use them as a for instance, who may be attempting to assert a right, a divine right of kings, if you will, or a divine bloodline.
Sure.
Do they have any connections, or are there similar goals in mind there?
There's similar goals. I think if we look at what's happening to the world today, we're going to be having to make some pretty hard choices in the next 20, 30 years. If the environment continues to deteriorate, if conditions domestically in our own country continue to deteriorate, if things start to go wrong in too many places, you're going to find the only people showing up with a plan are going to be the last people we want showing up with a plan. And I think that they're going to be very effective because they're going to say, this is what we have to do. These are the hard choices. We're going to have to make these choices now. I think you're going to have people listening to this, because right now our leaders are kind of all over the place. No one seems to know what to do or what's going on, or no one's taking decisive action. Some people are going to react very well to a leadership that comes on the scene and says, we can take the decisive action. We can do what has to be done. Just give us the power. And I think they're going to take advantage of a lot of our fears and paranoias. Maybe the environment's not going to deteriorate, but it's going to look like that. You know, we're going to expect more hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes. People are going to get frightened about that. They're going to get frightened about immigration. Immigration is a big issue for these people. You know, this is something they love. This is something tailor-made for them because it's a code word for racism.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things are going to come into play. You know, the environment is being created. The political environment is being created, but someone who is an inheritor of these Nazi ideals would find it very easy to come on the stage and in a very gentle and covert way still take control and still get the things done that the Nazis wanted to get done 60 years ago, 70 years ago.
Hmm. And offer a way to create order from chaos, as it were.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Peter Lavenda, the author of Unholy Alliance, A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. Before we go, where can people find the copy of the book and, of course, the three-book series, Sinister Forces, The Nine, A Warm Gun, and The Manson Secret?
Well, Unholy Alliance you can get pretty easily on Amazon.com. It's in sale. In fact, it's going into a Spanish edition this month as well. It's been translated already into five different languages, so you shouldn't have any problem finding a copy where you are. Sinister Forces, of course, is also on Amazon, or you can contact the publisher directly with an 800 number. If you're not on the Internet, you can call 1-800-556-2012, and you can order copies of Sinister Forces from him.
Very good. And when will The Manson Secret, the third volume of the Sinister Forces trilogy, if you will, come out?
That should be ready by June 30th at the latest, I believe.
Excellent. Peter, it's been a real education and a pleasure once again, and we look forward to having you back when The Manson Secret is available.
I look forward to it.
Yeah. Peter Lavenda, our guest on PID Radio. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
And we are long overdue for that return visit with Peter Lavenda. We highly recommend his three-book set, Sinister Forces, and his previous work, of course, dealing with Nazis and the occult. You can find out more about where to get those books at his website, which is sinisterforces.info, www.sinisterforces.info. If you have a comment about the program tonight or anything we do at PIDradio.com or peeringintodarkness.com, you can drop us an email at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. We'd love to hear from you and appreciate your thoughts and support. And until tomorrow, I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening.
This is PID Radio.